Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with #WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're learning more about yesterday's deadly Amtrak train derailment in Washington state. Investigators say the train traveling from Seattle to Portland was speeding through a curve at 80 miles per hour, nearly three times the posted limit. Survivor Chris Carnes described it to Good Morning America.
We felt like we were going into a turn, but then we felt some jittering. And the next thing that we knew it, we were flying off the rails and then down an embankment.
Chris Carnes is okay. Others are not. At least three were killed. Jim Blaze joins us now by Skype. He's a railroad consultant involved in many accident investigations. We spoke to him after that 2015 fatal Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia. And Jim, we know this train was on a new, faster route that was supposed to take 10 minutes off the trip. But this section, this curve, was clearly marked 30 miles per hour and the train going 80. Look, the engineer is injured. We don't know what happened. But your thoughts?
Well, I'm surprised that it came off at the top of the first curve. It didn't go through the two curves and then derail. It came off coming out of the first curve. That's unusual.
Yeah.
This equipment, also the Talgo train, has been operating pretty safely since 1999.
Yes, you're talking about Talgo, which manufactures the train. The train crews are Amtrak. The trains are either Amtrak or State of Washington owned after purchased by Talgo. So there's a lot of players here, but you're talking about the train itself.
Yes, the train itself has got a very sophisticated tilting system. So even though a curve of, let's say, 6 or 7 degrees, which is approximately what the two curves are near the bridge, are basically set for 30-mile-an-hour speeds, with the tilting mechanism, you would think that you would have a higher speed allowance. Now, so why was the train speed set so slow? Well, we don't know all the evidence yet, but one of the reasons is it's a newly constructed track, so the track may not be fully compacted. And I'm not sure that permanently this was always designed to be a 30-mile-an-hour bridge turn,
because
that's they spent $180 million to put this siding in. Why are you going to slow the train down to 30 miles an hour in the middle of it? That doesn't make economic sense.
Well, we wait to find out a lot of this, but meantime, that Seattle-Portland corridor has been equipped with positive train control. This is a system that automatically slows down a train, but that system was not scheduled to be turned on until next year. We know you've been involved with research on positive train control and that you are for it. So stipulating that, your thoughts about the fact that we have the technology, but it's not in place.
Well, first of all, the system should have gone live nationally December 2015. So we're 2 years late, and already some of the railroads, some of them government-owned railroads, so taxpayer-owned railroads, not private railroads, are saying, well, we may need until 2020. Why this delay? I think the people involved in making the economic decision of whether this was a good investment or not underestimated the true cost every time you have one of these accidents. I've calculated already with just three deaths and the damage to the trains and the legal suits that we could be talking $40 or $50 million or more to settle the claims on this. Now, do you have a car that's maybe 2 years old and has modern braking systems?
I have a car that does that. It stops me even when I'm not smart enough to.
Then why have the railroads fallen behind? Because the trucking industry, the bus industry, and the automobile industries that they compete with are clearly moving ahead with this kind of safety investment. Mm. What's wrong with the industry I spent my 40 years in?
You're very passionate about this. Look, yesterday after this crash, President Trump tweeted that the train accident that just occurred shows why more than ever our soon-to-be-submitted infrastructure plan must be approved. $7 trillion spent in the Middle East while our roads, bridges, tunnels, railways, and more crumble. Not for long. But this doesn't seem to be about crumbling infrastructure.
No, this is an all-new section of track. I'm not sure that President Trump's advisors informed him correctly that this was an all-new construction and that the positive train control mechanisms were basically in place but not turned on and running.
Yeah.
So they gave him bad advice.
Jim Blaze, a railroad consultant, economist, commenting on the accident that so far has taken three lives and questions about where was the system that could have braked that train. Jim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the House of Representatives has passed the Republican tax cut plan, which President Trump called one of the great Christmas gifts for the middle class. A Senate vote could come this evening. For more, we're joined by the former Republican governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty. He's now CEO of Financial Services Roundtable, a lobbying group for the financial industry. Governor, welcome back. And are you surprised that Republicans appear to have the votes to pass this bill?
Actually, I'm not. I've been saying for some time that if you're a Republican and you've run around this country for the better part of a decade saying that if we ever get in control as a Republican Party, one of the things that we will for sure do is tax reform, and then they didn't do it, they would have egg on their face to say the least. So I've been predicting for some time that, A, they would do it, that they would get it done in a timely fashion, and so this result is not surprising to me.
Will they have egg on their face, though, if, as some of the analysis suggests, this bill really benefits the wealthy a lot more than it does the middle class?
Well, the answer to that is maybe. But the big bet that the Republicans are making is that this bill will ignite the economy in ways that will grow not only the number of jobs, but will also elevate wages for the middle class. There's also some direct benefits for the middle class as well. But I think the bigger bet in the bill, the foundation, the cornerstone of the bill, is this bet that it will ignite the economy. If that does happen, then people may get more comfortable or supportive of the idea and its benefits. If it doesn't happen, Jeremy, I think there'll be heck to pay for the reasons your question suggests.
You don't sound like you're convinced that that will happen, though.
Well, I think there's a lot of other moving parts here that you got to think about. For example, there's been a recession every 7 years on average since World War II. The longest there's ever been between recessions since World War II is 9 years, and we're in year 8 of a recovery. So even if this bill or any other bill had some positive effects, if coincidentally we had a recession in the next 2 years, it could wash out some of what would have been the positive effects of a bill like this. And people could still be discouraged or mad. But in any event, even President Obama said you need to cut the corporate rates in America. You know, there's consensus around that on both sides of the aisle. I think there was just a difference around the level to which you would cut those rates. But even President Obama acknowledged that the American tax system needed to help make American businesses more competitive relative to the rest of the world. And so that was one of the key goals for this bill.
What about the impact on the debt? Are you concerned about all of this new debt? People are talking about over $1 trillion of new debt over 10 years that is going to be added to the already large U.S. debt.
I am concerned about that. It has to be balanced against some other things like the need for economic growth. We've had pretty anemic economic growth as measured by GDP. And so this bill hopefully will accelerate GDP growth in a way that will mitigate the impacts on the debt and the deficit. But I'm very worried about our debt or deficit. It doubled under President Bush. It's doubled under President Obama. And we're on a pace now to go from $20 trillion in debt up to maybe $30 trillion in debt by the time, you know, President Trump or his successor leaves office. So it is very concerning. And by the way, we only have about currently $3 trillion of revenues coming into the federal government. So that gives your listeners some sense of how deep the hole is. And those numbers I just cited for you don't even count all the debt. That's just the stuff that's directly on the book. So it's a big issue, needs to be tackled, but it's not going to be tackled just by one tax bill in one moment in time.
Well, do you expect Republicans will, in order to deal with the debt, start making cuts even to, you know, Medicare and Social Security in the next year? Is that what they're going to do, do you think?
No. I think the country is not ready for that discussion. Eventually, it will happen because not the cuts necessarily, but some reform around entitlement programs. If you look at how the federal government spends money, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and interest on the national debt is already over half the money spent. At the rate of which that's all growing, you know, it could be over the three-quarter line within a relatively short period of time. So the Republicans may tackle next some welfare reform, some eligibility around able-bodied people. But I don't think they're going to tackle anytime soon Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid.
What do you think about the unpopularity of this tax bill? A CNN poll out today found opposition to the bill has grown 10 points since November, with 55% now opposed to it.
Well, again, I don't think that's a big surprise when it's sold and presented as a corporate rate cut that also, you know, has a bulk of the benefits coming to either large businesses or in some cases wealthier individuals or entities. But again, I think the proof of the pudding is going to be whether it works, and works meaning does it ignite in a substantial way wage growth and job growth. But again, the notion that we could have continued the way it was to have America's corporations being taxed at the highest rate in the developed world and expect our companies to go out and compete in a global market wasn't realistic. And again, even President Obama and many Democrats recognized that. So it wasn't a debate about whether this should or shouldn't happen. It was a debate about how much.
How long do you think it's going to take to determine whether this works or not?
You know, I think it to have the effects of this take place beginning in 2018 and then roll through the economy to give it a fair chance, I think you'd have to give it a couple of years.
That's Tim Pawlenty, the former Republican governor of Minnesota, now the CEO of Financial Services Roundtable. Governor, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Christmas is coming. That can only mean one thing. Now, if you're thinking Santa or office party or world peace, we can hope. You're leaving out Mr. Christmas, Mr. Cohen, my high school choir director at John F. Kennedy High School in Plainview on Long Island, probably the biggest Jewish booster of the music of the holiday, wouldn't you say? Mr. Cohen, you have brought us a primer on Christmas music through the ages. Welcome back.
Shalom, and it's great to be here.
That's right, shalom. You want to start in the medieval ages, after the fall of the Roman Empire, about 500 AD to 1400.
The foundation is laid for the music notation and theory that we know today.
For Western music. And that is exactly what we were all thinking when we used to sing this with you. Let's listen. O come, O come, Emmanuel.
Believe it or not, it was written by a monk before 800 AD. It was discovered, in a way, you might say rediscovered, in the 19th century by an Anglican priest, John Mason Neal, while reading through a book of ancient hymns. The processional, as you know, that you were part of and has gone on for so many years, they're still doing it.
Yeah.
And I got an email last night from an alumni. They said 25 years later, they were sitting down and looking at the verses, and now that the meaning of the verses was hitting them, they wish they were back.
Yeah, because we probably didn't really get it then. But the processional itself, this idea of coming into a room, dark, you know, maybe candles.
Do you know that's a tradition of the English choristers, Robin, for over 1,000 years?
Yeah. Let's now listen to another late medieval piece.
Gaudete, gaudete, Christus es natus. Ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus es natus. Ex Maria Virgine, gaudete.
This is the King Singers version of Gaudete. Oh, love this piece. What does that mean?
Oh, Robin, Gaudete really means to rejoice. This was a monophonic hymn from the late medieval period, which was composed as a sacred Christmas piece in the 16th century. What I love about it is the great rhythm. Ba, 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 ba. It also has wonderful something to say because it talks about the virgin birth of the Christ child.
Ex Maria Virgine Gaudete.
Now we come to the Renaissance, 1400 to 1600.
We're going to listen to a piece called Omnia Mysterium by Victoria. We're going now from homophonic music, which is a single line with maybe accompaniment, to polyphonic, which is almost like a round. And when they listen to Omnia Mysterium, which is, means divine mystery, you can hear the Omnium coming in different voices, creating the most lovely harmony.
Thank you.
Next we go to the Baroque period, 1600 to 1750. Lots to hear here.
Right on the air, I'm going to give you a test.
Okay.
Are you ready?
No.
A little fun?
All right.
Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti.
Do. No.
Boy, that's quick. We'll use the T wanting to go to do, which is our key signature. This is our tonality, and it began in that period.
So tonality comes into being in this period. The top composers were Bach, Handel, Vivaldi. This is Break Forth from Bach's Christmas Oratorio. Let's listen.
This is a chorale, and it's sort of like a proclamation. A chorale is definitely a harmonized version of a single hymn tune, and it's talking about, again, the coming of the Messiah.
And that brings us to another piece from this period that's one of our personal favorites. This is from Handel's Messiah, "For Unto Us a Child Is Born."
In this piece, you take what they call, in the fancy term, a melisma, a melismatic phrase, a series of tones on one syllable. So you're going to hear, "For unto us a child is born." I can't even do it. I mean, give me a break. How the heck they do it? What a choir that's on this recording. The Academy of St. Martin's in the Field with Neville Mariner.
So we leave the Baroque period behind, sadly, but it's because we have to go to the classical period, 1750 to 1830. Three main composers in this period, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven. Tell us how the sound is evolving here.
Well, you've got a lighter, clearer, cleaner texture. Like the architecture in the Baroque is highly ornamental, like the music. But you now have, again, more homophonic, which in other words, a single line with accompaniment. This is just such a beautiful melody. It brings me to tears when I just love it.
Mozart's Laudate Dominum, here sung by Renee Fleming.
I'm telling you, music is my salvation, I swear.
You are killing me, I am dead. Okay, so lovely. But we're moving on to the Romantic period, 1830-1910. Even more emotional, intense feelings.
Absolutely. More emotional. Melody really takes over. You think of Frédéric Chopin and the beautiful piano music that he wrote. But would you believe Hark the Herald Angels Sing was composed by Mendelssohn, appearing first in 1739 in Hymns and Sacred Poems, and the lyrics, which we know, by Charles Wesley. Mendelssohn comes upon it and writes the melody as we know it today.
Well, and any opportunity you have to work It's a Wonderful Life into a segment, you do.
I have to. I discovered It's a Wonderful Life because I was listening out in New York. They were playing the late movie, and there was It's a Wonderful Life, and I'm crying. I'm going crazy. I called the station. They knew about the Kennedy Choir. They said, "Mr. Cohen, please, it's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in those films. It's not." I said, "Is it going to be on again?" They said, "Yes." I went back told the choir if they want to live to their next birthday, they will watch it. They came back. They went, oh, my God, this is fantastic. Became our movie. 3 years later, they had Jimmy Stewart on an interview, and they asked him, Mr. Stewart, do you have a favorite movie? He said, well, it's really not very famous, but It's a Wonderful Life. And I jumped up and down and went crazy.
Because people forget it wasn't critically acclaimed when it first came out. It was like
and
Stuck
only,
in Late
but
Night.
Now, and of course at the end, what do they sing? Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Glory to
So we are definitely skipping through music history here like a stone across the water, because now we are at the 20th century. So you've picked one piece, The Ceremony of Carols.
It's by Benjamin Britten, and it starts and ends with a processional, and it's called This Little Babe. And I chose it because the last time I was on, we talked about stretto, where you take an idea and you get so excited, you keep on coming in the middle, This Little Babe, This Little Babe, This Little Babe. And when you look at the lyrics of the piece, this piece is about the battle of good versus evil, the Christ child versus Satan.
So, This Little Babe from The Ceremony of Carols by Britten, ominous there, tension between good and evil.
Absolutely.
And all the...
But we know who wins.
And all the other music from Mr. Cohen, we will have it here in now.org. Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, thank you once again for your Christmas card in song that you bring us every year.
You're welcome.
Your phone rings, you don't recognize the number. It's another spam call, and we all get them, even if we've signed up for the Do Not Call registry. And complaints are surging. This year, there have been more than 7 million complaints to the registry. That's almost double the number 2 years ago. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rulin. He joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Well, and why the surge in complaints, and what kind of calls are people complaining about?
Well, so it seems that technology is outpacing the technology to stop it. There were more than 7 million complaints about violations to the Do Not Call registry this year, up from 5.3 in 2016, 3.6 the year before. The issue is that internet-powered phone systems have made it very easy for scammers to dodge the system. They can come up with these spoof numbers, these fake numbers that are not in the Do Not Call registry. So it used to be that the call you got, either it said do not, you know, no caller identified, or it had a 00 number.
Right.
But now you're seeing real numbers, which often look like a number perhaps in your area code, giving you the impression that it might be somebody local or someone you know, and that's the way the calls are getting through. The technology to defeat the Do Not Call registry is just better than the Do Not Call registry.
Yeah, I get probably at least 5 of these
sure.
calls every single day,
yep.
And oftentimes, as you say, the phone number is like almost exactly my phone
yep.
number, but
yep.
not quite.
That's right.
So why doesn't the Do Not Call registry, you know, get up to snuff on this and get to where they are up to date with the technology?
Well, this might be a case. So first of all, this costs a lot of money, right? Because it's annoying to you and me. I get probably 5 a day as well, but they actually have scams. There are actual ripoffs. They're
right.
either medical related or they're selling warranties.
Student loan debt, right?
Right. So people fall for it. So number one, that's dangerous. But number two, I think the hope is that the private sector might be able to solve this. So when you go to the Federal Trade Commission, their recommendations are check with your carrier about call blocking. Now, I've been looking into this. It's really much harder than you think. Once you've identified a number and you don't like it, you can, if you have an iPhone and some Android phones, you can do that. But you can't figure it out before that. So then there are call blocking apps. One of them is the most popular one is Nomo Robo. It intercepts robocalls before they get to your phone and it hangs up or sends it to your voicemail, but it also still depends on them having the number in the data bank. So when it gets through, I have that service, for instance, and when a call gets through to me that it didn't intercept, I then enter the phone number and they check on it and add it to the base. You know, some mobile phones have services. There are call blocking talking devices. But for the moment, this is going to be up to the private sector to solve, because hackers, for lack of a better word, just have more sophisticated technology.
Is the government even trying to solve it, though?
Not really, because I think it's one of these things where, you know, the FCC is collaborating with AT&T, with Apple, with Google, with Comcast, the parent company of NBC. They're trying to figure out ways. They do believe that these companies will probably have better engineers and better technology, and they want to figure out how to bring it all in under an umbrella. There's a system in Canada that's working. It's called Telemarketing Guard, and it's working unusually successfully. So there's some investigation into whether that system can be used in the United States. But this has just accelerated so quickly that the government hasn't been able to keep on top of it.
Well, and I keep wanting to just change my phone number, but then I can't even imagine what a pain that would be.
I've been thinking the same thing. Yeah. And by the way, when I got a new phone, when I joined NBC, I thought it was a new phone number because it wasn't. It was somebody else's phone number. So I get all their robocalls too.
Great. Yeah. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Don't call him. Thanks, Ali.
Bye.
Tamara Holder is speaking out, and she knows she might get sued for it. Let's back up. Tamara is a former attorney and Fox News contributor who reached a reported $2.5 million settlement with the network in 2015 after her allegation of sexual abuse. And as we heard from former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson, who also settled with Fox, she and Holder and all the other accusers had to sign a non-disclosure agreement that forbid them from applying for work at any Fox entity and from speaking out. But one of the clauses in Tamara's stipulated that she could break her silence if she was maligned or disparaged. That, she says, happened when Rupert Murdoch had this exchange last Thursday with a reporter from Sky News.
How harmful has the whole raft of allegations about sexual harassment at Fox News been for the business?
It's all nonsense. There was a problem with our chief executive. Over the years, but isolated instance. As soon as we investigated, he was out of the place in hours. Well, 3 or 4 days. There's been nothing else since then.
Well, that caused online outrage, given that many men have left the network over allegations, and caused huge payouts from Fox, including some for Bill O'Reilly's behavior, one for about $3 million to one woman, one for $32 million to another woman. So after the outcry, 21st Century Fox issued a statement saying Murdoch was not characterizing the claims as nonsense, but was instead referring to the idea that sexual harassment was an obstacle to the company doing business. But Tamara Holder says Murdoch's words give her permission to speak, and we are going to do that with a warning. Her description of the abuse she suffered is vulgar. It will not be for all ears, but it's necessary to distinguish between what Murdoch called flirting and sexual assault. Again, a warning. As Tamara Holder joins us by Skype from Chicago, Tamara, when you heard Rupert Murdoch's statements, what did you think?
Honestly, I was speechless. My mind just, it was like an electric shock had gone through my brain. The audacity of this man to say something like this. He and his company ruined lives, ruined them. There have been days for the past 2.5 years that I haven't wanted to go on anymore. And that's because of him and his company and what the people within it did to me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, so people might have heard a $2.5 million settlement. That's pretty good. But describe more about what you're talking about. The gag orders, the not being able to work at certain companies. Describe more what you're talking about.
Sure. Well, I had been with Fox for 7 years, and they paid me well. So I just want to point out the settlement amount. I've heard from people, well, yeah, you got $2.5 million. Okay, well, I just ask everybody, take away paying your attorney 1/3 of that, take away giving the government 1/2 of that. So the idea that because I was paid any amount of money and now I'm whole is preposterous, because now I'm left without a job and without any income.
Well, explain more, because you're not allowed to work at any Fox business.
Right.
And what are you also saying? Are you saying that there's some sort of black mark against you?
Sure. My agreement, first of all, was not you were harmed, therefore we are going to pay you. It is you were harmed, therefore we're going to pay you and you can't ever talk about us or the incident again. That's not what I wanted money for. In fact, I didn't want money. There were times that I, during this whole experience, that I just wanted to sue Fox for one penny.
Well, why didn't you do that?
Because the lawyers wouldn't take my case. That's why. I said, number one, I only want to sue Fox out of principle for 1 cent. And number two, I didn't even want to name the man who did this to me in the lawsuit because it wasn't about him. What lawyer is going to take a case for one penny? And they thought, you know, maybe I was lying.
Well, in fact, Fox is not disputing your claim. And this wasn't just flirtation. There's another part of the interview with Rupert Murdoch in which he says, NBC's in trouble, CBS, they're stars. I mean, there are really bad cases that people should be moved aside. And there are others which might have been a bit of flirting. That also enraged you. So people understand. But again, this is not going to be for all ears, so we want to warn people. What exactly happened?
I had something criminal happen to me. I had a man pull out his penis in his office and shove my head on it. I went into his office to talk about opportunities to work. This was my first time in his office. I had no history with him. We met in the cafeteria and had coffee and discussed opportunities. I started to write for Fox News Latino about sports. So it is important for people to understand. And sexual harassment is a serious thing. And I feel bad for people who are also just harassed at work. But for me, it was something criminal. I begged my attorney to allow me to go to the police. And she said, after we get the money, you can go. Because she wanted to take her money and run. So my advisor told me not to go. And number two, my background is in criminal defense and pardons. I know this man has family and has children. And as criminal and as awful as this was, I thought, I can do this on my own. I'll be okay. I'm going to do all of the work to rehabilitate myself. And I don't want this guy to go to prison.
So you're caught in this web of, you know, this indecent thing, this abusive criminal thing, this assault that happened to you. You're trying to figure out how to navigate, maybe get help for the guy, maybe get help for yourself. And what you get from Fox is a non-disclosure agreement. You can't even talk about it, and you can't work for any Fox entities. And it sounds like you're saying it's hard to get other kind of work when people know that you've sued. What do you think needs to happen? Because that man was fired. Bill O'Reilly was fired. Other men are being fired from Fox, but you still have Rupert Murdoch using words like flirtation and, you know, not a big deal. What would you like to see?
I'm not complaining about even what happened to me. Sexual harassment. Women are always okay. What we fought for was a right to vote and a right to work. And all we want to do is work. You can spend your time flirting with us and making stupid jokes and even grabbing us. Obviously, it's wrong. I'm not condoning that. But my point is that we have put up with this since the beginning of time. And we show up. And all I wanted to do was go to work. Salma Hayek, her article in New York Times, her op-ed about Harvey Weinstein, isn't about what he did to her. It's that he affected her ability to make a movie. I showed up to work that day because I wanted to work. I walked into his office because I wanted to work. And I went back to my desk after he did this to me because I wanted to work.
It sounds like if a woman comes with this kind of a complaint that nobody is denying, that woman should be keeping her job more cared for at work while the man is fired.
And none of us have our jobs.
Yeah.
So as we're firing Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly and Matt Lauer and Russell Simmons, these are men. that we are putting on the front page and we're talking about their names. The women behind these men are sitting at home today. And the emails that I have received are just stunning and heartbreaking. Hospitals, railroads, corporate America, union jobs, teachers, other women in TV, other women in radio. We don't care about bringing men down. We care about keeping our jobs. The woman who received $3 something million, Rudy backed her from Bill O'Reilly. Do you know that she's without a job? That was 13 years ago, I believe. Work is purpose for us. That's all we want.
That's Tamara Holder, a former Fox News contributor, speaking out about her sexual harassment settlement and the gag order that was imposed on her and the loss of work. Tamara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, Tamara says she has not heard from Fox lawyers yet. She knows she might. So your thoughts on women who lose their jobs in order to bring complaints against abusers? There's the hashtag now, We Just Want to Work.
3D printing has been around for about 30 years, but the development of new materials is now making it possible to build increasingly complex parts and products. These products could revolutionize virtually every aspect of modern life and perhaps transform life itself, as Bruce Gellerman from member station WBUR reports.
The promise of 3D printers is moving far beyond making custom inserts for running shoes or form-fitting earbuds. Scientists are now working on something a lot more difficult. Body parts, cells, tissues, one day, human organs. The BioX 3D printer looks like a white plastic kitchen coffee maker. Maybe a bit larger, but this is no coffee maker. Where the pot would go is a petri dish. Hovering above, guided by software, a narrow nozzle lays down thin layers. When done, the printer glows green.
Okay, so you can see in this, these are the different layers. So this is the print pattern.
Patrick Thayer demonstrates the 3D printer. He has a PhD in biomaterial engineering and is a senior scientist with the Swedish startup called Cell Ink. The company makes 3D bioprinters and living inks. Need a new part for an ear or nose? Cell Ink is working on it.
If you want a complex heart valve, you can put that together. That's awesome. Cool, the future's here.
I think right now we're in a super exciting spot. It's super exciting.
Eric Gottenholm is CEO of Cell Ink. He co-founded the Swedish startup 2 years ago. Already, it's doing business in 40 countries and is looking to expand. It needs to hire experts in biomaterials, chemists, cell biologists, software, and robotic engineers. That's why Cell Ink recently opened its U.S. headquarters in the high-tech corner of Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Kendall Square.
So Cambridge, I mean, naturally, Cambridge is the hot spot of biomaterials, biology, technology research, but it's the place you got to be.
Cell Ink makes and sells 3D bioprinters, but Gottenholm says the market and the big money are in the bioinks. That's living ink.
And what we saw as being novel as a company was that all these researchers were using the printers, but none of them had the ink. And the ink was, you know, the ink is everything. Imagine a paper printer with no ink.
Gottenholm leased, then purchased a patent for a unique ink, one made up of biological materials the printers could use to build layer upon layer of human cells.
The material, what was so special about it was that it allowed human cells to thrive and live in it and start producing tissue.
Cell Ink now produces 15 different biologically active inks to make cells and tissues. They range in price from $9 to $300, depending on their use.
So, for instance, a bone ink has a different composition and behaves differently because the bone cells need to thrive in that environment versus, for instance, an ink for a heart. Because the heart tissue needs softer, it needs to be somewhat elastic and things like that. So what we do now is we functionalize our bioinks for specific tissues.
So the average person should just think about Jell-O?
Harvard professor of biological engineering Jennifer Lewis is a pioneer in 3D bioprinting. Turns out one of the critical ingredients in making living inks useful in the printing process has the consistency of Jell-O. These so-called hydrogels are made from cellulose from trees and algae from the sea. Combined with the inks, the Jell-O-like material provides the scaffold that gives cells their shape.
And that kind of consistency is similar to what you might find in the body. So if we're going to do what we call bioprinting, we want to have not only that scaffold, but we want the cells plus the vasculature to really create a human tissue.
Professor Lewis and her lab team pioneered a breakthrough bioprinting process. Now they can create pathways in tissues for veins and capillaries to carry nutrient-rich blood. And they did it with 3D bioprinters.
We can now truly build into the third dimension.
Now the bioprinted collection of cells can function together as a tissue, creating a new tool for biomedical researchers. Again, Eric Gottenholm, CEO of Cell Inc.
Let's take, for an example, liver tissue. They can use our technology to print livers, and then pharmaceutical companies or other researchers can test different new drugs on these livers, or they can test different chemicals in these livers and see how they react.
Instead of testing drugs on lab animals or in test tubes, researchers will be able to use printed human tissues to create customized medical treatments. Harvard bioengineer Jennifer Lewis.
Ultimately, the goal would be to take a patient-specific cancer cells and then use that as the platform on which to screen the drugs to find out what is the optimal cocktail to give a patient if they have a certain type of cancer. And you can do that before you actually try these drugs on the patient. So it could be very powerful.
The first commercial application will probably be 3D skin tissue that can be used to test cosmetics and mobile 3D machines that can be used in the battlefield to heal a soldier's wounds. Cell Inc. CEO Eric Gottenholm predicts one day, perhaps in 15 or 20 years, 3D bioprinters could custom make kidneys, lungs, and hearts for transplants.
There is so much we can do with different biomaterials. The potential is unlimited. We're aiming for the stars.
For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.